Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to a January 31, 2009 segment from the Kentucky Water Fuel Museum. With us tonight is Michael Riversong, who is a professional musician and an environmental consultant and an author and founder of the Tesla Academy. Michael, are you with us?
Yes.
Oh, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Yeah, it's an honor to be on with you.
Yeah, it's been almost a year since we met at the Jarboe's Mill event in Southern Maryland.
That was an awesome event. I was really thankful that I got to go to it and that it came off. You know, it was really, I think, a significant step in creating new energy systems.
Okay, and you know that there's going to be a part two coming up at the end of May.
Oh, okay. I hadn't heard about that yet. Not sure if I can make it out there at that time. The end of May is always a very big time for me here in Cheyenne.
Okay, so you are in Cheyenne, Wyoming.
That's correct.
And so perhaps we can acquaint our audience with who you are and how it is that you came to be involved with alternative energy. Just how far back does your interest in alternative energy go?
Oh, gosh, all the way back to college. I graduated from college at the University of Colorado in Boulder in 1974, and during that time I was looking at some of the early alternative energy installations in Boulder, and I thought that was pretty cool. I didn't really do anything about it until 1980, and at that time I got hired to be an assistant in a solar laboratory in Crested Butte, Colorado. And that was quite an interesting job. We were putting together a what at that time was a pioneering installation of phase change salts for storage. And that was one of the experiments that proved that the phase change salts were just a little bit too expensive and too unstable to really work that well.
No,
you know, one of those
for.
Things
not
that's a nice idea on paper.
Exactly what do you mean by phase change salts?
These are special chemicals that basically were designed to hold heat for a long time and then quickly change their state, their chemical state, as the heat was given off.
Hmm.
So it was an efficient storage method, but the problem was the chemicals were a little bit unstable and they sometimes escaped their little containers.
And so this is a way of storing solar energy?
Yeah, this was a method to store solar heat. Solar heat storage has always been a difficult problem, and I've known of some other experiments in that line, too. And since we're on the subject, I might as well mention one fellow in Southern Colorado who I knew. He actually put together some large tubes of water and was keeping tilapia fish in them, trying to breed them. And this was in a solar greenhouse that he had attached to his living room. But he found that there the problem was just keeping the water clean. So there have been a lot of things tried. The one thing that seems to work the best is just stone mass. And, of course, if it ever gets cold, then it's very difficult to get it heated back up again.
The idea being to heat a mass of stone?
Yeah, just have the sun blast down on it for several hours, and it does store some heat. And it's the nice thing about solar stone storage is that it's relatively easy to maintain, unlike some of these other schemes that have been developed. But we still need something better. And I really think that the type of electrolysis that you're working on might be a really key answer.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Yeah. Now, I think I'd like to dive into that. Well, just a little bit more about background. After that, I got into my own business installing solar systems and then got into studying Buckminster Fuller's synergetics. And also in 1984, I started working with the International Tesla Society. So I got well acquainted with all of Tesla's research lines, and he was looking into many different types of energy production and efficient devices of various kinds, including turbines and transmission systems and things like that. So
at that time, you were still in Colorado, is that it?
Yeah. Yeah, I moved up to Wyoming in 1993, so I've been working out of here since then. And actually, that's because Cheyenne is a nice base to travel from, because it's just on Interstate 80. And at the time I moved up here, I was on the road most of the time, going out teaching and performing.
Now, when you say performing, what has been your instrument of choice?
Normally, it's the Celtic harp. And that's actually been a part of all this science work as well, in an interesting way, because I also play a few other instruments, but mainly it's the harp now. And the idea behind that is I serve the scientific communities as best I can by providing music at conferences. The music is precisely designed to be uplifting and helpful to, you might say, brain operation. Although there's actually more than that.
This is quite a unique combination of skills and the manner in which it's presented.
Yeah, it's actually an outgrowth of an ancient tradition called the Bards. And Bards, beginning with B, were a class of musicians who integrated history, medical practice, and music.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it's quite a responsibility, and that's part of my life's work, is to revive that. And, of course, every bard would serve a community, and I serve the local community here in Cheyenne, of course, but I also serve the scientific community on a broader geographic base. And so I've been at all of the old Tesla Society symposia that were conducted in the 80s and 90s, and then since then, I've been working a lot with the extraordinary technology conferences that are put on by Tesla Tech. And those are really, really good conferences. So they bring together a lot of inventors and scientists of various kinds. And we're really hammering at these. Pardon?
Was there one of those this past summer?
Yeah. There was one in August in Albuquerque, and there's going to be another one this coming August also in Albuquerque.
And what has been the thrust of those conferences? Is that primarily involving the Tesla electricity generation type technologies? Or?
It's all of his research lines, which is very interesting because he actually branched out into medicine as well. He created some of the earliest electromedical devices, and then it also goes into like charged water and things like that. We often have presentations on that subject. These things are interesting partly because they are the parts of Tesla's research that are definitely working. The energy stuff, well, that's a little more difficult to get working, and I'm hoping that we'll have some breakthroughs in that. And, of course, this goes back towards the electrolysis, because one of the things that Tesla did, which I think we could do with electrolysis, and that's really one of the big reasons why I decided that this would be a great idea to get on the show, is to put out the idea that Tesla had found resonant points in the operation of electricity. And that's how come we have AC power generation. That's actually a case of somebody applying the principles of resonance to electricity. Now, every musician knows about that. If you pluck the C string on a harp, the other C string, an octave above, will start vibrating all on its own. And that's a good example of resonance. And you also see it even in any stringed instrument. You'll see that type of resonance going on wherever you have the same note at different octaves. And so what I'm proposing is that we should really look at how we're building these electrolysis devices with an eye towards finding resonant points. There may be harmonics, and this is something that that's what octaves are. They're harmonics of a fundamental note. And there may be harmonics of the frequency of various elements that would allow us to build an electrolyzer that would resonate at a certain point and operate much more efficiently than it ordinarily would.
Yeah, creating a standing wave in the cell?
Essentially, that's what we're looking at, some kind of standing wave in the cell.
You know, it's funny how you can find information in the least expected places. But I picked up a used book at a library book sale dealing with natural disasters, and it made reference to how a tsunami, how the wave becomes much more intense when it has a second wave bounce back and intensify it.
That's understandable. And, of course, they also it's interesting because one of my assignments this week involved showing a movie about a super volcano, a possible eruption of the entire Yellowstone caldera. Now, this was a science fiction movie, but they got many things right in there. One of the things they got was that before a volcano erupts, there has to be a certain resonant environment, and they have a special kind of earthquake that starts showing up on seismographs that they've named harmonic tremors. So it's the same thing.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, yeah. So we're looking at a lot of possibilities in terms of unleashing the power of resonance in the next few years. And as researchers start looking at this, hopefully prompted by their friendly neighborhood musicians, we're going to find a real advance in this field.
Well, that is an amazing note, if you want to use that word as a cliche or as an irony, that on the note of music, you know, that it's not necessarily white coats who come out with these ideas, but it's more the artists that propose some of the non-conventional theory.
One of my favorite quotes comes from Isaac Asimov, where he said, "The greatest advances in science historically have not been accompanied by shouts of Eureka. More often, they've been accompanied by someone saying, huh, that's funny."
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's true that white coats, the problem with getting a position as a professional scientist, often that's where somebody's research stops, because once they've got the salary and they've got their family taken care of, they can just kind of kick back for the rest of their lives, and there's not as much incentive to continue the work. And I've seen this quite a few times in our field.
Yeah, well, and that could be true in non-conventional alternative energy as well as the official labs supposedly pursuing alternative energy.
Yeah, it's one of the greatest roadblocks to making progress. It's sad but true, and it's just a part of human nature. I mean, I've lived, well, in Crested Butte, as I mentioned, there were quite a few people up there who didn't have to work. They were what we called trust funders, and they all went nuts unless they had a purpose. If they got a purpose on their own, then they would be okay. As a matter of fact, this fellow I worked for as his solar energy assistant, he was one of those people who did find a purpose. He owned a bunch of oil wells, didn't have to work, and he went kind of crazy. He got in a huge speedboat accident, so he decided to move as far away from water as possible, which meant Crested Butte. And there he got onto the purpose of researching solar energy. And he was a wonderful person to be around because of that.
So what did he come up with as the pinnacle of his research?
One thing he found out was that even in that incredibly harsh environment, because they typically get 8 to 10 feet of snow in town in the winter, and he found even under those circumstances, with a lot of cloudy days, and also Crested Butte had a disadvantage of having a large mountain to the west, so about one-fourth of every day, there was no sun. You know, you'd still have light, but the sun was behind the mountain. Even under those circumstances, he was able to produce more heat than he could use. And part one of the things I worked on was an installation of a hydraulic window that would open when there was too much heat in the greenhouse just automatically. So he had a greenhouse, and then inside the greenhouse, he set up a couple of solar water heating panels, and those were just cranking. It was incredible.
And we're talking about a solar collector then, is that it? Or?
Yeah, solar collectors inside the greenhouse. And the greenhouse itself was glazed with the standard double fiberglass that you have to use in those mountain environments.
It makes me wonder why the solar collector isn't a much more common device.
Well, a lot of it is government social engineering. That's really all it was, because in 1985, the solar tax credits expired, and that just completely crashed the solar industry, while the oil industry and the coal and nuclear were all getting breaks and sometimes even huge subsidies from the government, and solar couldn't compete under those conditions. I always appreciated what Dennis Hayes was doing at that time. He had been a key alternative energy official under Jimmy Carter, and of course he was thrown out in 1981, and from there on just kept repeating the same message: we need a level playing field. That's all. He said, either restore the solar tax credits or take away all the credits from all the oil and other energy industries, one or the other. And if either of those things had had happened at that time, of course, we would be in a lot better shape right now.
Yeah, it certainly hasn't been a level playing field, that's for sure.
Yeah. Now, getting back to solar, one of the things I found, though, that even without tax credits, but nobody knew this, of course, one can get some incredible economies from the simpler solar systems. One of the problems in the early 80s, and I think one of the reasons why the tax credits were allowed to expire, was that a lot of people focused on water systems. And the problem with water systems is, in most of the continental United States, you can't really run water directly through a solar panel, because sooner or later there's going to be a freeze, even in Florida, and your whole system's gone. So they had to go with the relatively inefficient method of heat exchange. And the minute you put a heat exchanger into a system, you're wasting some energy. And plus, you're multiplying the possible mechanical problems that can come up. So this was a real problem at that time. And if you just put together a solar air system, you wouldn't have those problems. And I found that we could get a lot of, you might say, bang for the buck just by doing simple carpenter-built on-site solar panels. As a matter of fact, there's a group, one of my favorite nonprofits, it's called Trees, Water, and People, and all they do is they go up to various Native American nations and install this type of solar panel on their houses.
And this is where you're basically taking something as simple as black pipe, like drain pipe, or you know, PVC or ABS pipe, I guess you call it.
Mm-hmm.
You're making a box on the roof of a house, and you're letting air pass through those heated tubes, huh?
The neat thing is you don't need to use tubes even. As a matter of fact, tubes aren't as efficient in this application. What you want is you want something inefficient inside the solar panel. So certain types of grate wire, and also certain types of louvers or just sheet metal folded a little bit, any of these will work. All you have to do is paint them flat black. And there are special flat black solar paints that don't outgas very much, and those are what you can use. And you don't even need to go on the roof, because you can lean a panel against a house or in an extreme environment, and I've seen these work. You can just mount the panel flat on the wall vertically, because you'll still get enough in most of North America from the winter sun because of the angle that it takes going into a vertical panel. So, I mean, it's amazing. Very simple, very cheap to put these together.
Well, in fact, there are people that have shown that you can do this with beverage cans, aluminum cans.
I wouldn't doubt it. Yeah, aluminum cans are great because, again, they're very inefficient. And so they'll pick up a lot of heat.
Right, and you're just connecting them. You're taking the ends out of them, I guess, and using them as a conduit for air to pass through. As in aluminum, it does a good job of transferring the heat.
Yeah, it can pass through and or around the cans.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little bit of a stretch to do something like that, basically, because you're increasing your labor time. It's just like those earthship houses, you know. It's like, yeah, it's really cheap, but the problem is you're sitting there for hours and hours pounding sand in the tires, and with a pop can collector, you'd be sitting there for hours and hours stringing together the pop cans.
Yeah, I think there's some YouTube video of people showing how to make such a system.
Cool. Yeah, and it's things like that. You know, the thing about solar energy is that your initial cost is always somewhat large compared to, say, a gas burner, because a gas burner has few parts. So, yeah, just throw in a gas burner and that's cheap, but then you have the residual cost. The nice thing about solar is you don't have any residual cost, but you do have a high upfront cost. But with these air systems, that cost isn't as high as it is, say, with water systems or even the more exotic things like parabolic collectors or photovoltaics.
Yeah. So that is an excellent way that our dependence on, for instance, natural gas could be greatly reduced in North America.
Yeah. And, of course, another way we could reduce dependence on natural gas is to use it as a transition fuel. And this is something that Ty Robinson advocates, because it is so convenient to access. Right now, you could convert engines to natural gas, and then on down the line, when we get better hydrogen production systems going, we can just switch very easily. Because, as I understand it now, I haven't actually done hands-on tinkering with this, but my understanding is that the only difference between burning natural gas and pure hydrogen is a tiny adjustment in an aperture opening. And that's it.
Yeah, the volume of gas, that's true.
Yeah.
We're talking about a pure hydrogen fuel, and then, of course, an oxyhydrogen fuel requires a little bit more tweaking.
Yeah.
But to convert from natural gas to hydrogen is no great feat.
Right. And this course that Ty Robinson has recommended, I think, makes a lot of sense, because right now we do have one serious technical problem with electrolyzing water using wind power, and that's the variations in the wind power. And it became clear this summer, a man from the National Energy Research Laboratory, NERL, he was at a conference that I went to. It was called the Hydrogen Implementation Conference in Laramie. And he said that they are working really, really hard to find a way to account for the variations in electricity flow that naturally come with wind power. And so that's a matter of building control circuits.
Well, then the other option is to use the sun's energy in a solar collector to produce the heat necessary to break down water with a catalyst.
Yeah. And again, in solar, you're going to have some variations, but if you do it on just a pure heat basis rather than electricity basis, I would imagine that you would have different problems. But I have seen some very promising parabolic solar designs lately that look like they should work out fairly well for this type of operation.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing about it is that you can use photovoltaic or the heat type, you know, collector to break water down.
Yeah, and I haven't seen any rigs yet that did direct heat to break down water, but it certainly looks possible. Parabolic collectors have always been a troublesome technology because you have to keep them focused, and the focusing mechanisms can get pretty elaborate. Any astronomer can tell you that. Actually, the entire technology for keeping parabolic solar panel, solar reflectors really, focused was developed by astronomers a long time ago. So it's a matter of just transplanting the existing technology there. But
yeah.
Still, it's rough because there are a whole lot of things, including wind hitting the installation that can take it off kilter, and you have to find some way to be on top of all that.
Yeah, you'd think that with all the high-tech gadgetry that even our children play with, that we'd be on top of this, seeing it is such a promising source of energy.
Yeah, well, the only way we're going to do that is just to start from where we are and just keep developing this stuff, keep researching. I know about all the different setbacks that have happened throughout the years, and there's a lot of stories that are pretty horrifying that I don't tell because I want people to focus on doing the next step. And part of it is what I call a dandelion phenomenon, because if you get enough people researching, there's going to be no way anybody can stop that.
True. There just has to be that, you know, plethora of interested persons pursuing it.
Yeah.
Which high energy prices tend to create, but then when it dips back down and there's other economic issues going on, like we're experiencing now, people can quickly forget how important it is to focus on this kind of problem and solve it. You know.
Well, it's why I'm dedicating a significant portion of my life to going out there and teaching all this stuff. Because everything I've talked about here I have photographs for, and I can teach it in a class environment. And, yeah, presentation teaching isn't always the best way for people to learn. I understand that. But in many cases, it can be a catalyst, and it can get people working. And that's what I'm trying to do. That's why I'm actually at the moment I'm planning a tour of the West Coast. It'll either happen over spring break in early April, or it'll happen in the fall. But one way or the other, I want to get out there and teach as many classes as humanly possible, both on the Tesla technology and on the alternative energy.
Well, that's excellent. There needs to be a bunch more of you.
Thank you. Yeah, well, and for me, there just needs to be a bunch more work, and that's what I'm working to cultivate right now, is to find the people who can put these events together locally. Because
yeah.
Every class depends on a local key person to get it rolling.
Now, how do you incorporate music into the classes, or do you?
I do. I always play a little bit of music at the beginning of each class. Sometimes I'll play some music during the class to demonstrate the principles of resonance. And with some of the more advanced students, I can actually use particular musical intervals to demonstrate complex chemical reactions.
Isn't that interesting? Well, it must make it much more enjoyable for your students to have that kind of integrated music integrated presentation.
Well, I hope so. You know, it's unique, but I think it would help in some ways, and if it gets a few extra people into a class, that's to the good as well.
Or if it gets a few extra people into the music.
Yeah, well, that's part of it too, because I could talk for hours on the whole music situation, because right now our society has for many years been drifting more and more towards fairly harsh music. And I personally believe that a lot of the harsh music has created mental states in people that contributed to the current economic crisis.
Oh, I would say so too.
Yeah. And so hopefully one of the things that will happen out of this is that people will start looking for more gentle forms of music, like the type of stuff that I tend to play. And that's all available on the internet, too. I've put up probably a little too much free material for people to download, but some of those free things are geared for specific health situations that tend to blow out people's ability to have money. So I figured, well, let's just have them free, and maybe some good will come out of that.
Well, why don't we at this point then tell people where they can find these free tracks they can listen to?
Okay, those are accessible through the www.biblicalbards, that's biblical as in the Bible, and then bards.org, and that's my main site. I have a number of other sites as well, and they're all kind of interlinked together. From the Biblical Bards site, there's a link to the Tesla Academy over on the left.
Okay, now, some people's brains may be going into an overload type situation right now as you bring the Bible into both Tesla and,
Well, keep in mind, Tesla was the son of a priest.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, his father was a Serbian Orthodox priest.
Okay, so it shouldn't be too surprising that a biblical bard would have something to say about Tesla and alternative energy.
Yeah, and the thing on the Bible is that I encourage people to study that, just like I encourage people to study synergetics and various other lines that are beneficial, because when you do that, you also get some idea of how to form and maintain workable community structures. And that's fairly important, too, for survival right now.
Okay, and how is that part of the biblical aspect? Wherein does that connection lie?
Well, that's a whole huge subject in itself. It's massive. But throughout the Bible, there are themes that consistently tell people how to create good communities. And the number one thing, and I don't care if somebody wants to be religious or not, that's not my thing, because it's each person's individual choice. But if people were to do one thing that's consistently recommended throughout the Bible, and that's to avoid gossip, communities would be much more livable and workable.
That's very interesting.
And that's one of the reasons why I don't get into this whole thing about conspiracy theories and all that, because in many ways that's gossip. I want to focus on the science, the stuff that works.
Very, very interesting. Yeah, well, that's what I set out when I opened the Water Fuel Museum in Lexington, Kentucky. I let people know up front that it isn't about conspiracy theories. And unfortunately, that's how the press tried to paint it. The local newspaper implied that it was all about conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
But actually, it was just a presentation of the history of the technology.
Yep. Yeah, and the thing is, the press has to be encouraged to become more enlightened. And that's a matter of, when you meet individual reporters, just doing as much as we can to help uplift them, because reporters have very tough lives, I know.
Yeah, that's true.
So if we can show kindness to our friendly neighborhood reporters, that'll probably help advance technology as well.
Yeah, very true. Yeah, there could perhaps be a tendency to view them with some suspicion.
Yeah. Well, and reporters have to be suspicious to some degree, but sometimes it gets ridiculous.
So I take it you've had your share of contact with the press in trying to publicize your events and so on.
Oh, yeah. And actually here in Cheyenne, they've generally been very good to me. So I'm very happy with some of the reporters that we have here.
But have you found, as you've traveled around the country, that there is a reticence on their part to even report something that is going on having to do with these things as you've traveled and attempted to get a press release or something?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it doesn't, to them, it doesn't seem like it's going to help sell newspapers or gain TV ratings, which are the two things that really drive all this. So it's a problem, and it's not a problem that's easily addressed, but we have to keep plugging away anyhow. And, of course, there have been frauds, too, which, kind of mess up the field a little bit. And I've had to deal with a few cases like that over the years. There have been a few times I've had to go in and interview someone or try to survey their technology or whatever and have found that there's something lacking, usually honesty. And, of course, press people can feed on that. But, you see, they have a mindset that says that, well, people are kind of stupid and you got to get them excited so that they'll come in and watch what you're presenting. And that's a terrible way to think, but that is, unfortunately, the way many press people think. And we have to do what we can to change their thinking and also, to some degree, put out good press ourselves, like what you're doing with this web show.
Yeah, there has to be some counteracting influence to
yeah.
point out the reality of the truth or the legitimate technologies that are out there.
Yeah. Yeah, and, it takes a lot of people. And the thing is, the inventor is only one part of it. The inventor is absolutely vital, of course, in the chain or in the web, really. But in order for an invention to come out, the inventor has to be supported by good PR people, good administrators, sometimes good salespeople, and they all have to be operating from some form of honesty in order for an invention to make it into a market. And one of the things we deal with, I'm a member of the New Energy Congress, and one of the things we deal with constantly is the idea that an inventor ends up being his own worst enemy. And that's the paranoia that gets fueled by conspiracy theories and all that. And it's also sometimes greed that an inventor figures, well, I made up this big thing and, I should be a billionaire. Maybe. But unfortunately, the fact is that you need all these other support people. You got to make sure they're supported as well, that they get their families fed and clothed and everything. And so it's very rare for an inventor to be in a position to actually make a tremendous amount of money from any invention. And the best inventors, and incidentally, the happiest inventors, are the ones who are willing to more or less give it away, or at least to share the profits.
Yeah, I would agree. But since it doesn't seem to be that the two skills are really compatible, being both an inventor and a marketer.
That's correct, and very rarely. And there's a lot of reason for that. I think it has to do with the way humans are created in the first place. Because we have to ask ourselves, well, why weren't we created so that each person could be self-sufficient? And obviously the reason is that it was intended from the very beginning that humans would have to depend on each other in order to learn from each other.
Yeah,
and it's hard.
Be a society consisting of many parts.
Yeah. Yeah, this idea of a guy who can do everything, I mean, well, there really isn't anybody like that in the first place. I always like to think of the story of this one survivalist in the late 80s. Of course, there have been survivalists going for a long time, and this guy had really gotten it together to a point where he was consulting other survivalists, and he had a place, I believe it was in North Carolina. And he was way up on a mountain, and he had, like, this little road that he had three or four little places where he could set booby traps or ambushes at will. And he had, like, 3 years' food stocked up, and you know, just had everything perfectly fit together so he could survive. And up in that beautiful mountain, he died of a heart attack.
Yeah. Or no one would come to help him because of all his booby traps.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, we really do need to form communities, and that's going to be the key to survival, really, I've never owned a gun, and a lot of that comes from an idea of, well, you know, yeah, maybe there's going to come a time when people are shooting each other a little bit or something like that. I hope not, but it could happen, I suppose. And if it did happen, the only way a guy like me would survive is to make sure I'm a little too valuable to shoot. But then when you look at it, everybody's too valuable to shoot, because each person on this planet has some kind of purpose and some kind of skill. Even if it's just like, and I've seen some developmentally disabled people, and you got to wonder, well, what in the world are they here for? But I've seen many of those people hanging out, transmitting tremendous amounts of love to everyone else. And that in itself can be a purpose.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, very true. So, do you have anything in the works for the near future? Then I know you mentioned you may go on a teaching tour in the spring, but anything else coming up that you would recommend listeners to partake of?
Well, I'm also planning a tour to the East Coast in June and July, and actually that process is a lot further along than the West Coast tour. In Philadelphia, there's a group called the Nikola Tesla Inventors Club that's putting together a series of events around Tesla's birthday, which is, I believe, July 11th. Hope I got that right. Anyway, so in Philadelphia, there will be several events connected with Tesla there at that time. And then I'm also preparing for the Extraordinary Technology Conference. That's www.teslatech.info. And that conference is definitely worth going to. And then for people who can't or don't feel like going to conferences, I've taken a lot of my work over the years and documented it and condensed it onto two CD-ROMs, one dedicated to the advanced energy Tesla research lines and the other one more conventional alternative energy. Matter of fact, I have photographs of that laboratory in Crested Butte on that disc. And also tremendous amount of writing and very specific technical writing and reports on conferences and things like that. So those are available through my website. Right now it's a little hard to get to the catalog page, but it's there. The link is on the site, and those CD-ROMs are available and hopefully useful for people.
Now, this is the website that I have posted on this Blog Talk Radio page. That's home.earthlink.net.
Home.earthlink.net, and then a slash, and then a tilde, and then M Riversong. And that is my main gateway, actually. That has links to all of the different sites in one place, and that's all that's on that page. And so that's a good place to start from as well.
Yeah,
because
so I have it copied on the Blog Talk Radio show description page, if anyone wants to just copy it off of there.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, and that's a good link, too. Yeah, like I said, I have several websites. One of the reasons I do that, by the way, is because too many people have had the experience of having a key server go down or a provider go out of business. And this way, by having several different websites with different providers, it makes it possible to stay up all the time, one way or another.
Right. Well, very good. Well, Michael, it's been very nice talking to you, and hope we get to see each other again at another event. The Jarbo's Mill, the 2009 version, is going to be held at the end of May at a site near Larry Jarbo's place, but not on his property.
Okay.
So.
I'll kind of keep an eye out for that, and if there is a way I can make it, I will. That would mean leaving for the East Coast tour a couple weeks earlier, and it's possible. And
well, I know that everyone present at the event last year enjoyed your playing and your presence there.
Thank you. Well, that's good to know.
Happy to have you again.
Okay. Well, thanks for having me on the show, and very much appreciate that.
Well, thank you, and maybe we can do a follow-up interview at some time in the future to hear the latest of what's been happening.
Sounds good.
All right, well, you take care.
Okay, and great joy to you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.